We're hearing this week about the state of public pensions across America. Today we visit Kansas and Nebraska. The two are quite a bit alike, big farm states, proud of their pioneer heritage. But when it comes to the way they approach their pension funds, they couldn't be more different. Nebraska has its funds in top condition, while Kansas is in terrible shape. KCUR's Frank Morris reports.
Lots of people don't have a retirement plan. But among those who do, there are two basic types, the 401k and the traditional pension plan. Now, the traditional pension has just about disappeared from the private sector, but it's still quite common for government workers, police, firemen, teachers, and it can be a pretty good deal.
We are living right now on the same amount of money that we were living on when I was teaching the whole time. And when I get Social Security, I'll actually get a raise.
Clifford Manning retired 5 years ago as a high school band teacher here in Topeka, Kansas, at 59 with full benefits from the state retirement system. But at the rate Kansas taxpayers and state workers are contributing to the pension fund, the state can't sustain this kind of pension indefinitely.
The chickens have come home to roost.
Anthony Hensley, a Democrat, is the minority leader of the Kansas Senate.
I mean, it's been years and years of neglect. Now we have a unfunded liability that makes our system, according to this new Pew report, the second worst in the country.
At the beginning of last year, the fund was over $8 billion in the hole, less than 60% funded and losing ground.
I don't know. I'm a native Kansan. It is a little surprising.
Glenn Deck runs the pension fund from his office here in downtown Topeka. He says the benefits Kansas gives are relatively low, so that's not the problem. Deck says a bit of bad advice set up a mess in Kansas. When the state raised benefits in the early 1990s, an actuary told lawmakers that investment income would cover the difference.
It was reliant too much on, you know, great investment returns during that time and the belief that things would continue to go up, and the world changed.
The stock market tumbled and didn't fully recover. Gradually, the state began to raise contributions. Then it cut benefits sharply. New hires have to work longer and contribute more before drawing pensions. Not enough. The fund is still deteriorating. But since pensioners keep getting their checks, Kansas Senate President Stephen Morris says it's hard to get his colleagues to pay attention.
Well, sometimes you see eyes rolling and people looking away and, you know, why do we have to do this? But we do.
Sickly pension systems do not right themselves. They snowball. But it doesn't have to be this way.
All those in favor vote yay, opposed nay.
About 3.5 hours north of Topeka, in Lincoln, Nebraska, Senator Dave Pankinen chairs a committee overseeing a pension system in near perfect health.
Nebraska has had this tradition of consistently looking at the plans, trying to take action as needed, instead of waiting and kicking the can down the road until it's a full-blown crisis.
It's more than a tradition, it's state law. Unlike their colleagues in Kansas, Nebraska lawmakers are required to keep the pension funds flush. That makes Phyllis Chambers' job easier. She runs the pension system. Her actuaries calculate the amount the state can expect to pay out in pensions. They balance that number against contributions made by workers in the state plus investment income. If there's a shortfall, Chambers simply hands lawmakers the bill.
This is your liability for the year. It's not an if, but it's more like this is what it is.
Another difference is that Nebraska's pension fund is much smaller. There are fewer workers to cover. Most of them are on a 401k type system, with the state more than matching worker contributions. It's almost impossible for the state to end up with big pension liabilities. Judges, highway patrol officers, and teachers have traditional pension plans, and as you might expect, they sound pretty happy.
All indications are to me that we're protected and everything's going to work out really well for us.
Robin Stevens here is attending a retirement seminar in Omaha. He's a school superintendent. He's heard about the trouble with the Kansas pension fund and thinks it might be making it easier for him to recruit new teachers.
When we have openings in Nebraska, it seems like we're getting more Kansas applicants.
Stories like this and various studies have turned up pressure on Kansas to fix its pension fund. It's not going to be easy. Senator Morris wants big increases in workers' mandatory contributions to the fund and the amount the state is putting in. But the state already faces an enormous budget shortfall, so it's hard to imagine where the money would come from. There's also talk of phasing out the traditional pension fund altogether and moving to a 401k type system, more like Nebraska. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
President Obama is just about to sign historic health care legislation into law at the White House.
Today, after all the votes have been tallied, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
The signing ceremony will take place, is taking place, in the White House East Room. NPR's Scott Horsley is at the White House and joins us now. Scott, this is a huge day for President Obama. Could you just describe the scene?
Well, Linda, the signing is taking place in the East Room, a large ceremonial room here at the White House, and there's always a sense of event when the president speaks there. He is surrounded by many of the lawmakers who voted for the bill, as well as people whose personal stories of health care hardship helped to inspire this legislation. There's obviously an atmosphere of celebration in the room. The lawmakers were chanting, fired up, ready to go. There's also a sense of history. A lot of people are snapping pictures. They want to record this moment.
And what did the president have to say?
Well, he said that with the signing of the bill, the overheated rhetoric about the overhaul will confront the reality of the overhaul. The White House is counting on that. They think that people, when they get to know about the consumer protections in this bill, will lose a lot of their skepticism or their downright opposition to the reform.
And what will be next? I guess sort of something like what we're seeing now, the selling of the legislation and its immediate benefits.
Well, that's right. And later today, the president's going to give a second speech about this health care bill. Our colleague Julie Rovner likens it to the big reception one might hold after a smallish wedding. The East Room, as big as it is not big enough to accommodate everyone who wanted to be a part of this historic event. So they're going to hold a second event for about 600 people at the Interior Department. They might have done that outside on the South Lawn, but they were a little concerned about bad weather. Of course, as it turned out, it's a pretty nice spring day here in Washington and a very sunny day for the Obama administration.
Thanks very much, NPR's White House correspondent, Scott Horsley.
Good to be.
Cornell's men's basketball team is the feel-good story of March Madness. The Big Red, as they're known, are the first Ivy League team to reach the Sweet 16 round since 1979. And to do it, they've had to beat some basketball powerhouses, Wisconsin and Temple University, in the past week. They have done this without the benefit of athletic scholarships. There are none in the Ivy League. Nor with any likely top NBA draft picks. But one member of the team who's been described as the Cinderella player on this Cinderella team is senior forward John Jakes, who joins us now from Ithaca, New York. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. And we should explain that you're a senior, but your position for most of your career there has been bench.
Yeah. You know, I was obviously my first few years wasn't seeing much time off the bench, but now another senior on our team, Alex Tyler, has had a nagging injury this year on and off. So, you know, I've had to step forward and play an increased role. And, you know, as the season's gone on, I've gotten more comfortable each day. And going into our next game against Kentucky, I'm feeling pretty confident.
Now, in addition to playing and going against Kentucky, in addition to all that, you are also the blogger-in-chief of the Cornell basketball team. You should explain your other
career. Yeah, that's correct. I've been lucky enough to blog for the New York Times online sports blog, The Quad, for the last 3 years. And I just try to provide the reader with, you know, insight into a league that not many people know about and a league that's different from basically every other one in the country. So I've had a great time doing it.
So how do you approach your next game against Kentucky? What's the psychology for doing that? Now, on the one hand, you know, the other big favorite to be in the final game, Kansas, was upset. There have been several big upsets. No matter what Cornell does, if you come out and lead for 2.5 minutes, it will be the high water mark of Ivy League basketball in decades. So just by showing up, you guys have succeeded incredibly. How do you keep your objective high? How do you concentrate on winning when, my gosh, everybody in the world's going to pick Kentucky in this game?
Well, I think it just comes from our own opinion of ourselves. I think we have high expectations of ourselves in general, so now that we're here, I don't think we're satisfied. You know, knowing our team, we're extremely confident, and I think we're going into the game expecting to win, because if you don't do that, then you really have no shot going in. So
you have to walk out on the court, no matter what the writers say or the odds makers say. You have to walk out assuming that you can beat that other team.
Yeah, I mean, I think that playing against Kentucky is obviously an incredible story for our program and for the league in general. But you know, we can't think that way. We have to think of it as just a game where we're playing against another team, and though that team's, you know, an incredibly talented team, if we play our game, we'll have a chance to win.
Does it help Cornell basketball that it's really unlikely that any of your teammates would leave after their sophomore year to go to the NBA or, you know, enter the draft after a year or two of varsity ball?
You know, people coming to Ivy League schools, you're right, they don't, their goal isn't, when you're going to Ivy League school, your goal isn't to make the NBA draft. That's just not something you think about. So while we have a few guys on our team who you know, mm-hmm. are playing extremely great basketball and, you know, might have future professional careers, I think if you're not thinking about that sort of thing and you put team first, it can go a long way on the court.
Well, John Jakes, good luck to you in the next game. Tell us when and where Cornell plays Kentucky.
We play on Thursday night at 9:57 in Syracuse at the Carrier Dome. It's our next game.
And are you going to get some reading from your spring break done before that game? Are you actually going to do a paper or two between now and then?
Yeah, I should be able to. I have a couple classes I need to take care of, but hopefully I can focus a little bit on basketball until then.
Okay, well, good luck to you.
All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Senior forward John Jakes of the Big Red, the Cornell basketball team, which has made it to the Sweet 16 round of the NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
So much of our financial life is managed on computers now, it seems inevitable that we should use mobile phones or internet-enabled smartphones to do our banking. It's on the agenda at the Wireless Industries Annual Conference this week in Las Vegas. We called Morning Edition's technology commentator Mario Armstrong to find out more. Mario, welcome.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me in.
What about this thing that I'm hearing about called Bump?
It's a piece of software that currently runs on the iPhone that enables you to take my iPhone and bump someone else's iPhone that has the same application, and we could exchange dollars right there physically by bumping our hands together.
Are you really talking about knocking into something? I mean, a literal bump.
A literal bump. It's just a tap. It's like two hands coming together for a slight tap. Back in the days of Palm Pilots, you would actually aim one device at another through infrared, and you could beam contact information. Well, it's the same idea, but now we're moving it into transactions, and now it's a little bit more physical, not just based off of infrared.
Is this safe? I mean, what if I just came up to you and bumped your cell phone when you were using it? Would I then have all your money?
Well, it depends. Do you have a nice bank account? No, I'm just kidding. First off, you have to have a PIN or a password that's assigned to every transaction. And that's supposed to help, you know, prevent any unauthorized use. But however, as mobile payments and using mobile devices to pay for transactions rises, we will obviously see more types of security threats in this area.
I wonder if maybe one day you'd be able to go into Walmart or Macy's or something and just sort of point your phone or bump your phone into the cash register and use it like a credit card or a debit card.
Absolutely. I mean, that's happening in a lot of other places across the globe. You can, in Austria, for example, in Korea and some other places, Seoul, Korea and other places, you can use your mobile device to make those types of transactions like you just imagined. Starbucks is doing a test in select markets where you can use your iPhone and it becomes your Starbucks card. So you'll be able to check your balance, register your card, and make purchases. In Arkansas, we're seeing that they have become the first state to offer mobile payments for e-government services. Things like secure payments for inmate trust account deposits or probation and parole supervision and restitution payments and property tax payments. So I do see more mobile transactions taking place. And I still think that the industry overall, Linda, still has to define what a mobile transaction really is. Is it what you just defined, kind of replacing the credit card process? Or is it just doing some of these things where we can buy things off of the web, off of our phone?
So, Mario, do you do your own banking on your iPhone?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. You know, I had a certain amount of hesitancy initially, I think like everyone else does, but as you become more used to doing it, and the convenience is really incredible, the ability to transfer funds on the spot or look at multiple accounts on the spot, to be able to have almost a virtual wallet at your fingertips is something that I see definitely happening more prevalent in our near future.
Mario Armstrong is Morning Edition's regular technology commentator and host of the show Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio Station WYPR. Foreign correspondents Paola Buterini and John Tagliabue fell in love over late-night dinners in Rome. They also shared traditions of family feasts. Their work took them to Eastern Europe, where a nightmare began when John was shot by a sniper while reporting in Romania. Tagliabue's wounds healed, but the shooting sent him into a lengthy and severe depression. Paola Buterini's new memoir, Keeping the Feast, is about the couple's struggle to recover, how a return to Italy and preparing and eating food helped. Paola Buterini joined me from Paris, where she lives now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, as soon as you could, you decided to go back to Rome, where you all had met and married. Give us an idea of what daily life with your husband was like when you finally got past his convalescence and you were in Rome dealing mainly with depression.
It was completely unreal. A man who had always been warm and talkative became utterly silent. He would spend much of his day wrapped up in the bedclothes. I could find him banging his head against the iron bedstead or against a wall if a doorbell rang. He was unable to take telephone calls, anything that reminded him of life outside the four walls of this little apartment where we were staying became a terrifying event. It made life very, very complicated for the two of us, and the only way I could get through a day was to try and focus just on that day. In the mornings, I would get up very early, and we lived right near the Campo dei Fiori, a wonderful open-air market in central Rome.
Now, almost as much of the book is about that, is about food. And that account of the Campo dei Fiori, that was your first notion that that would make everything better, that it would help?
No, I don't think when I started going over there, I had any notion that anything would help. It was simply a matter. Those were the few minutes of every day, that early morning, I would get up and go over there. He was still asleep, so I didn't have to worry what would happen to him. I could just go over there and do the daily shopping and pretend that life was a bit normal. And I would take these fruit and vegetables home or some meat or whatever, and I would focus during the day on three meals. And it was simply the act of not thinking about the future that helped calm me down.
One of the things that you write about at the Campo dei Fiori is asparagus. And at one point, you write about going on a kind of asparagus bender.
Well, I think that when asparagus would come into the season, in Rome it's nice and early, and it would come into the season and suddenly you'd see it everywhere. Every day I'd go to the market and ask a different vendor, well, how are you going to make it tonight? How will you or your wife make it tonight? And I'd just go home and try different recipes. It certainly wasn't that I was thinking that eating asparagus was going to somehow make us better. But everything that goes with the idea of the winter season leaving, and you're leaving behind all that dark and cold and death of winter, and you're coming into the period of light. And so asparagus became a metaphor for getting better, for hope that his condition would improve.
He'd been sick for quite a long time when all of a sudden you just sort of hit a wall. You stopped being patient. You got angry. And in the book, there's an account of that that starts on page 184.
Yeah. I watched him just ahead of me, walking like a stick figure, rigid, tense, knees locked, rocking from side to side as he made his way slowly across the piazza in front of me. And for the first time since he had fallen ill, I felt not a whit of pity or sorrow, but only pure, murderous anger. Anger not just toward his illness or our circumstances, but fully and directly toward him, for letting his illness utterly hijack our life. Before I knew it, I had become the madman, and found myself howling at him at the top of my lungs in the middle of the piazza, screaming and crying that if he didn't stop walking like Frankenstein that very instant, everything would be over between us very soon.
That happened to you? What happened to him?
It seemed to me that within a very short time after that point, I began to see more signs of improvement than I had seen in nearly a year's time. I think my anger sort of awakened him at some level. He saw that my patience was not going to be eternal. It may have been that simply coincidental that the illness was beginning to pass somewhat, but certainly he knew on no uncertain terms that it was time to show me that he was getting better.
When your husband began to get better, he started cooking. So what did that mean to you?
Well, he had always cooked before he was sick. For me, the fact that he was starting to cook again was one of the clearest signs that he was getting better. I can remember when, about a year or so after he was really sick, we went to visit friends and their daughter who was having a birthday party, and John decided he would make Monte Bianco because it was September and the chestnuts in their yard were ripe and we were picking chestnuts off the ground, and he made this dessert. It's a very homey, old-fashioned Italian dessert, and he made one for her birthday. Well, for me, that was the clearest sign that he was able to come out of himself and think about somebody else. It was a wonderful day.
How is he now?
Now he is probably the best he's been since the shooting 20 years ago. I would never say any of us were the same as we were before, but we're certainly not wallowing in self-pity or feeling depressed or anything like that. We're both in good shape.
Paola Budorini, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Paola Budorini's book is called Keeping the Feast. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Monte.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today we're launching a new series, The Hidden World of Girls and the Women They Become. The series is a collaboration from NPR, independent producers The Kitchen Sisters, and you, our listeners.
Over the next few months, we'll bring you stories of women and girls from around the world. Stories of coming of age, rituals and rites of passage, secret identities of women who crossed a line, blazed a trail, changed the tide. Today, the Kitchen Sisters take us to Kingston, Jamaica, to explore notions of beauty and just how far some women are going to obtain it.
Some girls, to be more attractive to the male, they get themselves into this use of chicken pills. I'm Carol Turpin, St. Catherine, Jamaica.
Chicken pills are the same pills that you give to the chicken to make them grow faster. Some people use it if you want to get broader hips or bigger bottom. My name is Jason Turpin. I'm a college student from Kingston. In our Jamaican culture, you know, we love a girl that has one of the shape.
Most males, they love to see women with big bottoms. The whole idea of a Coca-Cola bottle shape.
When they're talking about a Coca bottle shape, it's like more heavier down on the hips.
I don't want a maga woman. That's how the men would speak. You say mega, we say maga. They're figuring that if you look maga, you look poor, and poor in the sense of you're not being taken care of.
I need a fat girl.
If you have a big bottom, that means that you're sitting on a lot of power.
I'm Carolyn Cooper, Professor of Literary and Cultural Studies at the University of the West Indies, Mona, Jamaica. In our culture, you get competing norms of beauty. There's a kind of anorexic, Eurocentric model of beauty. Also, a much more Afrocentric body type that is valorized.
If you have no meat on your bones, the society can't see your wealth, your progress, your being. My name is Sonia Stanley Nile. I am a lecturer in cultural studies at the University of the West Indies. We have these conversations in the culture about conceptions of the ideal body. It's in the music, the dance halls. There's a particular song about the woman whose derriere is of such quality, flexibility, and panache that she can successfully, with vim and vigor, ride the motorbike back and be a visual spectacle.
It is a beautiful sight. I'm a love to watch, to see the young girl upon the bike back. Bike back, girl.
What I find amazing is the degree to which women will put themselves at risk to fit an image that they consider to be ideal.
Action. You have got a chicken pill? You can't do that. Try and stop me.
My name is Raquel Jones. I'm 21 years old and I'm from Kingston, Jamaica. I was casted to play a lead role in a short film, Chicken Pill. It's about two teenage girls, one getting more attention from the boys in the class. The other character, Lisa, is having self-esteem problems, so she turns to the chicken pill.
Oh, here's something to look forward to, Lisa. Diarrhea, rashes. Oh, I'm sure Ronnie will like rashes on those new breasts. And cancer, Lisa, cancer.
I am Dr. Neil Persad Singh, a dermatologist in Kingston, Jamaica. Chicken pills, the harmful ingredient is arsenic. Over the years, I've seen quite a few people who have taken the pill, mostly women. I think they're a little bit secretive about it, and they don't want their friends, etc., to know. The government, they have banned the importation of chicken pill. However, the pill is freely available all over the island.
I am beautiful in every single way. Birds can bring me.
I'm Donna Hope Marquis, lecturer in reggae studies at the University of the West Indies. Women are using other forms of artifice and skin bleaching, which is fashionable, while it's damaging to the epidermis.
I'm proud of my bleaching, cause my cream it dear. My eye rub on my doctor, look on my face.
They have all these concoctions. People mix up toothpaste and bleach powder, rub it on. The skin starts to have a sort of reddish appearance, which means that your epidermis is being burned.
You can get bleaching products on the streets of Kingston downtown in the markets. The same place where you're buying them chicken pills.
I bleach about 2 weeks now, so I'm brown and pretty.
This used to be only women who would bleach their skin, but now men are doing it.
I'm Gabrielle, and I'm at Princess Street. I bleach to look good.
If you're white, a lot of people won't find any fault about it. But if you're black, it's a big problem, right? All around the world.
What you're looking at in Jamaica is a society that has emerged out of the trauma of slavery. If you grow up as a black woman in a culture that says black is ugly, then it's going to be a constant fight to affirm your sense of value.
If you want bleach on, bleach in, fit your bleach on, bleach on.
Captain Barkey has a song called Bleach On. Basically, if it works for you, continue doing it. Dancehall music also ridicules the bleachers and likens them to monkeys and people who are vampires and have to hide out of the sunlight.
In the day, it is all right. But in the night, that's when the monkeys come out. Come.
Queen Africa has a song. She's a Rastafari artist, very popular, and she feels that bleaching is a negation of your African self.
My complexion is better than ever. Brown skin.
I think at the end of the day, these practices are not intended to diminish, but to assert themselves as women.
Beautiful young ladies, Miss Jamaica World 2009.
Jamaican beauty contests have been fraught with social contestation. 1955, they had this multiracial competition. The lighter-skinned women were named after flowers, Miss Lotus and Miss Apple Blossom and so on. And the darker women were named after hardwoods, Miss Mahogany, Miss Ebony. Immediately you would know the flowers and the fruits would win much more readily than the hardwoods.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
Ooh. Over time, the aesthetic has changed. 2 years ago, Zara Redwood, Miss Universe, the Rastafari black woman with organic dreadlocks. She has what we'd say in Jamaica, a broad nose, and she has full lips. That kind of image 50 years ago would never be parading on any stage as beautiful. So we have to see that we have come a long way in terms of the society's readiness to accept multiple models of beauty.
I'll be standing taller to face the darkest.
Our story, Chicken Pills, was produced by the Kitchen Sisters and mixed by Jim McKee as part of the new series, The Hidden World of Girls and the Women They Become.
If you've got stories and ideas for the series, you can send photos, videos, and diaries to the Kitchen Sisters. We'll tell you how to do that at npr.org.
Funding for The Hidden World of Girls is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.